It's a funny place to be, stuck in a seemingly mundane world with an inner knowing that the universe is so much more than our mortal minds can comprehend. Yet we all have the capacity to know peace and our oneness with the wholeness of life. And through these interviews, discussions, and reflections, it is my intention to share this possibility. I'm Ryan Kurzak, and this is the Kriya Yoga Podcast. Okay, welcome everyone to the Kriya Yoga Podcast. I'm here with a very special guest, Roy Thibodeau. He is a Kriya Yoga teacher and a Kriya Yoga meditator. And I first met Mr. Thibodeau many years ago at Center for Spiritual Awareness when he was ordained as a teacher through Roy Eugene Davis. Mr. Thibodeau's His Kriya Yoga teacher was Yogacharya Oliver Black. Is that the proper way to say his name, Roy?
Yeah, we call him Mr. Black, or lately we've been calling him Yogacharya Oliver.
Okay. And Mr. Davis and Yogacharya Oliver, they were brother disciples. They were both students of Yogananda, and they were both wonderful teachers. And my goal here today is to kind of bring into your awareness this other branch of the Kriya Yoga family tree. So it seems to me that Mr. Thibodeau and I, we must be Kriya Yoga cousins if I follow right.
I think that would be accurate.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for being here, Roy. I really appreciate you taking the time for this.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So one of my first questions for you is, how did you first become aware of Kriya Yoga? What was your introduction to the Kriya Yoga system?
Well, probably like so many of my generation, and probably even in your generation now, that, you know, my first exposure to Kriya Yoga was through reading the autobiography of the yogi that was given to me by a friend. And it was one of those things that I'm sure happens to so many, that I was just so taken with the book that I just had to take the lessons, find out more, and then eventually later the year get initiated by Mr. Black.
And the lessons that you're talking about, were those the Self-Realization Fellowship lessons, or did Mr. Oliver Black also have lessons available?
No, they were SRF. He was for his whole life, he was an SRF minister.
Okay.
He was one of the founders of SRF, you might say, helped to build it. And so he was always loyal to that, that segment. And so he required for us to get initiation to take the SRF lessons.
And so the Song of the Moorian Ranch, that was his center, and that was also an SRF center, or was that, how did that fit in?
Well, you know, that's a sticky question, as you might imagine. It is not part of SRF officially. Uh-huh. We occasionally, maybe once a year, or maybe once every 2 years, we get a couple of monks to come up and stay there. And put on a class or two. But when he started it, Yogananda and Yogacharya viewed it as a Midwestern headquarters for SRF.
Okay.
It never evolved that way. But it was Mr. Black's wish always that we be closely aligned with SRF. And we're, the board of directors up there are still working on that. They were, three of the board were at convocation this year, and there have been discussions with Brother Hidananda and Diamata and Merlini before that, but it has never really gotten to that point yet.
Right. And so just for those who are listening, then Oliver Black and the Song of the Moorian Ranch, this was something that, that he and Yogananda were working on while Yogananda was alive. Is that correct?
It started. It didn't take shape until really the retreat didn't open until 1970.
Oh, okay.
But it was discussed, and you know, Mr. Black was a true yogic mystic, so he had all kinds of visions and materializations with Yogananda in his presence, and even before his Mahasamadhi. So he took all of that into account as he progressed and eventually officially opened the retreat in 1970.
Right, right. Okay. And, you know, I'm always interested to hear, you know, what your relationship was with Mr. Black. You know, what did you learn? How did his personality appear to you? Just, did you have any interesting stories about, you know, your experiences with Yogacharya Oliver?
Well, I have all kinds of stories, and but I don't want to bore everybody.
You won't bore them.
The thing I find out about a lot of stories is, you know, when you, I always viewed Yogacharya as my guru, almost since the day I met him. And that's, that in itself is controversial within SRF, as you probably are aware.
Right.
And so I never, particularly when he was alive, never made a big deal about it, but I, there was a group of us, I'm going to say maybe as many as, hard for me to say really, because I don't know how everyone viewed him, but I would say there was between 20 and 30 that viewed him that way. The rest probably just viewed him as an advanced disciple of Yogananda's and a spiritual teacher.
Right.
As you know, being in this lineage, that the guru relationship, disciple relationship, is a little bit stronger and more sensitive than just a teacher-student relationship.
Right, right.
So, go ahead.
I was just wondering, did he... How did he approach that? You know, was it mainly, you know, did he encourage you to do the SRF lessons and then, you know, come to the retreats with him and just learn from what his experience is? Did he have any kind of particular viewpoint on that kind of relationship, or did it even come up?
Well, it did, and he was always sensitive to it because of, you know, he didn't want to ruin his relationship with SRF. He was always approved by them to give Kriya Yoga initiation. And, but while Diamata was alive particularly, he was, you know, he's very close with Diamata, and he, a lot of the monks who came to visit the ranch, you know, it was perceived outside as a, you know, a real momentous thing for the retreat. Mm-hmm. But the fact is they came to learn from Mr. Black.
Right.
And, when he opened the retreat in 1970, it allowed him to shift his work a little bit, because before that he had a center in Detroit, which was nice, and it was, he would get 300 or 400 people every Sunday at his Sunday meditation service from all over the Midwest, but even all over the country. And he had big followings in Chicago and Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toronto, Milwaukee, and then, but when he opened the retreat, and then he moved up there for the most part, he was available all the time, which before that, he was only available on the Sunday morning, and if he had another meeting, he might be available, but he wasn't available all the time for everyone.
Right.
So he could take on a bigger role when he opened the retreat, and I didn't know him before that.
Okay.
So when I met him, I went up there and I lived there with him because I wanted to have what I've read about in the autobiography that Yogananda had with Sri Yukteswar.
Right.
So that I moved up there and he was able to give that to me, but he wasn't overt about it. He didn't broadcast it because that wasn't approved in SRF, you might say.
Right. And when did you first meet him? How long ago was that?
It was March of 1972.
Okay, okay. And I know he was a businessman, correct? I mean, before he was able to retire and do all this, what kind of work did he do?
Well, as you can imagine, being in Detroit, which he wasn't born or raised in Detroit, he was born in Ohio, but raised mostly in a town called Rockford, Illinois. But in 19... I don't know if it was the late 19, teens or if it was 1920, but right in that area, he moved to Detroit when he didn't have any children yet, but he was married. And he started a business for himself in the automotive industry. And of course, then the automotive industry was kind of in its infancy. And he built a company called Peninsular Metal Products. Mm-hmm. And at its height, he had like 1,500 employees. And he became fairly wealthy.
And so he was one of those individuals, I mean, similar to Lahiri Mahasaya, who was very much engaged in the world and engaged in the business community, but also was able to, you know, attend to his meditation practices.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I would, you know, I think that's a good comparison because Lahiri was a householder and had a job. But I would compare him maybe a little closer to James Lynn in America.
Right, right. Okay.
He wasn't as wealthy as James Lynn, but they were great friends and similar backgrounds, you might say.
Right. And so for those of you listening who might not know, I'm sure you do if you've read Autobiography of a Yogi, but James Lynn was one of Yogananda's most advanced disciples, who was also an extremely successful business person. And Yogananda attributed his success in meditation on the yogic path partially to the fact that he was so successful in the world, because success overlaps, you know, that sort of pattern or that mentality of success. The way it works in one situation tends to overflow into another situation as well.
That's right.
Did he make a big point of, you know, encouraging his students to act in that same way, to make sure that they were grounded in the world and taking care of their responsibilities, or was that something he just didn't really, he let them do their own thing? How did that work with Mr. Black?
Well, you know, whenever you learn things from your guru or teacher, they're always shaded by your own personality. So
right.
Whatever I say, remember it's my personality, my personal feelings. And I have a bunch of recordings and he wasn't against people becoming a monastic, but I don't think it was a very strong point with him. Although his guru was, and you know, there's a monastic order in SRF out in California.
Right.
I heard him say one time that, you know, if you have to go hide in a cave to be spiritual, what do you do when you come out of the cave? If the world swallows you up, what have you really gained?
Right.
He said, he thought the higher method was to be able to be in the world, function in the world, but yet be a saint or a sage.
Mm-hmm.
In my life, he was my example. He was the perfect example of that.
Right.
That's what Jesus did, by the way.
Right. I do remember Mr. Davis saying, I think he was telling a story that Yogananda had told him, that he had said, you know, I have met the yogis who go off into the Himalayas and hang out in the caves. And he said, during the day, they argue about philosophy and religion. And during the night, they argue about who gets the firewood.
Yeah. Well, you even look at it, Yogananda as an example. You know, we all know him to be a swami and a monastic. But the reality is he did all of his work in the world. He built this great organization. And he didn't hide away in a cave.
Right.
He was very public and speaking and traveled all around the world in the U.S. And he built this huge organization. You don't do that sitting in a cave.
Right, right. Yes. And, you know, you've had numerous years as a Hatha yoga teacher as well. So you've been involved in teaching within the spiritual framework for quite a while, correct?
Sure, yeah.
When you think about, you know, all these years of working with individuals and, you know, aiming to assist them on their path, you know, do you have a particular theme or idea or something that you think that could really help people if they just got this foundation, if they just got this very basic idea that would help them from the very beginning to be successful on their path?
Well, you know, those are good questions. The thing that I've found that happens is when people are ready for certain changes or moving forward in their life, they meet the right person or they meet they get the right book, or and so there's, it's a two-way street. Even Yogacharya used to say, some women would say, well, said, how do you find your guru, or how do you know when it's your guru? He said, well, you know, it's really a two-way street, he would say. He said, God somehow brings them together. Hmm. The guru has to accept the disciple, and the disciple has to accept the guru. Hmm. And so I think that translates into almost everything on the spiritual path. But I try to boil it down to, and I do, I do Raja Yoga workshops, because I think Raja Yoga and the Eightfold Path give us a pretty good blueprint. It doesn't give us the actual techniques we need,
right,
but it gives us a blueprint in what each individual, each soul goes through on their journey towards enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the yamas and the niyamas is really the start. And if you haven't learned how to behave yourself, that's what Yogacharya used to say. So he said, you got to learn how to behave yourself. So you got to avoid the things you shouldn't do, and you got to begin to doing the things that are beneficial for you. And that is the start. And then you progress to asana. And asana is where hatha yoga comes in. So, like, for instance, I don't get any drug addicts and terrible people in my hatha yoga classes because they're not ready. They're not attracted to that. They don't come to it.
Right.
And then once you get them into hatha yoga, it gradually leads them into pranayama, which, you know, if you do hatha yoga right, it becomes pranayama. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our initial kriya yoga technique is really a pranayama, and it leads you to pratyahara, withdrawing from the senses. And it leads you back into concentration and meditation, finally into samadhi or enlightenment.
Right.
So I do a lot of seminars with that, and workshops, so I really have that ingrained in my consciousness. And when I teach people, when I interact with people, I kind of get a feel, where are they on this path? Where's their next step? Where are they going to go? And I try to provide that through my classes, and we run a meditation group, and, you know, most people, even in hatha yoga, they're not ready for meditation, but some of them are, and then they come to our meditation group.
So we're focused on this idea that you always start with the foundation of the yamas and niyamas, and I like the way you put it. It's essentially learning how to behave yourself. Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense, because if you've practiced the yamas and niyamas, then it makes it easier for you to focus on the ability to sit still or to do your hatha yoga practice, which gives you the ability to focus on the breath awareness or procedures, which then gives you the ability to turn your awareness within. It all builds upon itself.
It all builds on itself. And they're not completely distinct. They overlap a little. Like, you don't have to have your behavior completely perfect before you get into a asana, and you don't have to perfect your asana. And so some people think the step of asana is just talking about meditation posture, and if you're not into the physical practice, well, maybe that's what it is for you. But, you know, they overlap, and they automatically tend to lead to the next step.
Right. So, well, this brings up two questions. I'm going to do my best to keep them straight in my head. So the first one is, you know, when you interact, and you may or may not have this issue, so I'm interested to hear what you have to say. If someone comes to you and they're so sincere about wanting to learn meditation or to learn Kriya Yoga, and you kind of feel the sense that maybe they've not mastered the ability to behave themselves yet, how do you encourage them to do that without chasing them away? And I ask that because every now and then I have that situation where someone is so interested, but yet when I try to encourage them to focus on the yamas and niyamas, that seems to be the thing they say, oh, well, I can't do that. You know, and I'm wondering how other teachers deal with that.
Well, that's a tough issue. And I think if you study Yogananda's writings and some of the, maybe not in the autobiography, but some of the other writings, you were around Roy for a number of years, so you can view what he did and said. And I remember Yogacharya saying that, you know, and Yogananda says it, well, sometimes you take a chance with someone.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work out, well, you did your best, and then you let them go. because this is all really God's work anyway. It's not your work.
Right.
So, you know, and some of these, even for advanced teachers, are tests for them as well, you know, because they get, if you remember the story in the autobiography that this really smart friend of Yogananda's came to Sri Yukteswar, and Sri Yukteswar loved him. Mm-hmm. And he went away because he wanted to do something, and he started partying with his friends, and he became real worldly. And finally, Sri Yukteswar had to ask Yogananda to send him away because he loved him so much he couldn't do it himself.
Right.
So there was a test for Sri Yukteswar even in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're right. You before you really accept someone for initiation, you have to test them a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it has to be overly done, because like you say, you don't want to push people away. You want to give people that chance to better themselves and become realized in this lifetime. But at the same token, not everybody's going to follow through.
Right. Yeah.
You know, even you and I might have trouble with that sometimes.
Yes. Well, what Mr. Davis always used to say to me was, he would say, always look at your work as karma yoga. He would say, you can't control what people do or don't do. He would say, all you can do is try to give your best example and hope they catch on.
Well, you can't say it any better than that.
Yeah.
You know, the best teacher, I always tell my students, you know, we always want to go teach someone, and we want to kind of force them to do what we want. But the reality is the best teacher is always example.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're a hypocrite. No one likes a hypocrite. You know?
Right, right. Well, this leads me to the question, the other question, and you talked about Raja Yoga and that you teach classes on that, and I recently had someone send me a question asking, what is the difference between Raja Yoga and Kriya Yoga? And I'm curious how you might respond to that.
Well, I thought a lot about that, because there is a difference, I think. And this is what I've come to conclude, is that Raja Yoga, which also doesn't only include the Eightfold Path, and you're probably familiar with this, but Ashtanga Yoga is really Raja Yoga also. They're synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ashtanga Yoga includes the Eightfold Path. Maybe what Raja Yoga brings into play that maybe Ashtanga doesn't is Raja Yoga also brings in the five main paths of yoga. Bhakti, karma, jnana yoga, I forget the others anyway, but you know what I mean?
Cause yeah.
They're based on personality types, and
right.
All people are, you know, they have certain personality types, but I think Raja Yoga gives you the philosophy, and primarily it gives you the blueprint, but it doesn't give you any instructions how to do it.
I see.
Kriya Yoga is the actual instruction and technique. And that's why Yogananda says you're best to get that from a qualified teacher or guru,
mm-hmm.
where the guru can kind of customize it for you, you might say. They look at your personality and they try to draw it out of you. They don't force you, but they try to provide the techniques that are best aligned to your personality and to move you along in the most auspicious way.
Right.
So I would make that distinction. Kriya Yoga's actual techniques to get you through the Raja Yoga path. Raja Yoga doesn't tell you how to do anything. It just tells you what it is.
Right. So Raja Yoga is more of like the overarching philosophy, the umbrella, whereas Kriya Yoga is like a direct applicable path that you can put into practice.
That's right. So, for instance, yamas and niyamas, how do you work through those? Well, of course, until someone's ready, they're not going to. But there are definite techniques, and the techniques are, if you find, you got to first acknowledge you have a bad habit and you want to get rid of it. So then what do you do? How do you do that? Well, you only have 24 hours in a day. Nobody has any more. And you already fill up all 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to get rid of a bad habit, you've got to replace it with a good habit.
Mm-hmm.
Got to find the opposite and then start doing that. And that is difficult. So what's the fastest way? The fastest way is to find people who already have that good habit established in their life and then go be with them. Mm-hmm. And it rubs off almost by osmosis. That's the concept of going to a guru's ashram. You start to live in that environment and you can't help but become a saint.
Right.
If you can't stand it and you leave, it tells you, well, I wasn't quite ready.
Yes. That's good.
I mean, that's hard to accept sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, that brings up a very good point, and that is the idea that you tend to become like who you associate with and who you think about.
Yeah. It's absolute truth.
Right.
And so that gives you the idea, how do I change them? Well, you change the people you associate with.
Mm-hmm. Right, because if you're spending time with people who do not do the things which are detrimental, you're obviously not going to be so inclined to do them yourself because, well, no one else is supporting that behavior for you.
Yeah, it's not there. It's not available.
Right. Yeah. That's good. I like that. Well, that brings me to the idea of devotion. And I'm curious how Yogacharya Oliver approached this. When, you know, Sri Yukteswar is very much, he had this presentation of the Jnana Yogi, this figuring out. I don't even want to use the word mental, but that's as close as we can come with our words.
Yeah.
And Yogananda was more devotional. How did Mr. Black approach the integration of devotion and Jnana Yoga? How did he approach that?
Well, that's a good question. Not like I had with Mr. Black, and I looked at Mr. Black as my guru, but I had a fair amount of interaction with Roy, and I always joke with him that I looked at Mr. Black as my spiritual father, so he was my spiritual uncle, and we would laugh about that. But it's interesting, and I'll tell you a little story, and hopefully it provides the answer. Uh-huh. I have an audio where someone asked Mr. Black, this was before I met him, how he viewed himself, if he was, you know, bhakti or karma yoga or jnana yoga. And he thought about it for a minute. And he said, I'm a bhakti. Mm-hmm. And I would never have thought of him that way. I don't know how he would have thought of him. He just seemed to my mind, he could embody all of those things. Mm-hmm. But he saw himself as a bhakti. And then I was with Roy, and I wasn't by myself. It was in a group meeting. And you know how we used to have people write questions and put them in the basket?
Right, yeah.
You'd answer them in the satsang. Mm-hmm. And someone asked him how he viewed himself. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of perked up. They were interested. And after a few minutes, they almost laughed out loud because I would have never have seen Roy this way. I saw him more as a jnana yogi myself. Uh-huh. But he said, oh, I'm a bhakti. I would have never thought of Roy as a bhakti, but right. I thought about it later, and I thought, and also in view of what I heard Mr. Black say, and I thought, you know, there's a point in that final step between meditation and samadhi where you have to give up the ego, and that's why Shiva is considered the patron saint of yogis. Mm-hmm. Because in that last step, you have to kill the ego, or you have to destroy the ego. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you have to surrender. And I think it takes bhakti to do that.
Right. Yes, I agree. And I remember one time reading, I believe it was Ramana Maharshi. Someone had asked him about the difference between Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, and he had said that the path is essentially the same, because as a Jnana Yogi, in a sense, you're putting your attention on and trying to figure out and embody what this truth is, but the only way you can actually truly do it is by fully giving yourself to it, and so then the paths merge.
Yeah, and they're all the same.
Right.
Just a little different perspective on your way. And the closer you get to your goal, the more similar they become, I think.
Right, right. Well, another question I was wondering about, especially with your relationship with Mr. Black, is how did he view the possibility of waking up, of experiencing an enlightenment in this lifetime? What was his view on that? Did he talk about that very much?
You know, it's funny. I just listened to something this morning. I listened to an audio every morning as part of my morning meditation. And he said through the science and path of Kriya Yoga, if you want to bad enough, you can be enlightened in this lifetime. Hmm. And I heard him say that countless times. I just happened to hear it again this morning. I've heard Roy say it many times.
Yes. In fact,
he said that was the he felt the weaknesses of the, I'm getting into funny territory here, but
it's okay. We're all funny.
Weaknesses of SRF. Yeah. Is that he said, if you went out there today, I remember saying this, and talked to any of the monks and nuns out there, they mostly didn't consider self-realization a viable option in this lifetime until the very end of their life. Mm-hmm. And then they come back and get it next lifetime. And mm-hmm. he emphasizes, don't think that way. You want to get realized right now, this lifetime.
Right.
And Mr. Black used to quote the Bible. He had a strong affinity for the Bible, the Christian Bible. And he said, you know, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven lies within. And then he would add, he said, the next phrase that Jesus said was, and now is the accepted time. And then he would edit it himself. And he said, and that means whenever you can do it, whenever you get yourself in the right condition, it's always available.
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah. Well, to that end, did he, you know, saying that it's possible, and, you know, that was definitely something that Mr. Davis said as well. And, you know, he would quote Yogananda, who had told him, you know, not to look back, not look to the left, not to look to the right, but to look straight ahead to the goal and to go all the way, and that you could in this life. Yeah. With that idea of taking it, of really doing it, of taking it seriously, was there any particular, anything particular Mr. Black shared about that, about how does one who's taken it that seriously, how do they live their life? What are they doing that might be different than someone who's just kind of, you know, half-assing it, if you will?
Well, they go through the Eightfold Path. They first learn how to behave. That's the
right.
And
yes.
Then they, you know, they, and through the practice of asana, you get yourself healthy.
Right.
You don't have to be healthy to get realization, but it sure helps you so you're not distracted by the aches and pains and unhealthy body. Mm-hmm. And it also allows us to live long enough so that we can do these things this lifetime.
Right.
You know, back in the Middle Ages, the average lifespan was 35 years. Those were terrible times. And you come realize that you probably had to become a monastic because everyone else died too young.
Mm-hmm.
Now we, and especially in the U.S., you know, Roy lived to be 87. Mr. Black lived to be 96. You know, so we have the time if we put in our practice. And that's the thing. You know, the guru or the teacher can't do it for you. It's always your responsibility. They show you the way. They can help you and they can teach you, but they can't do your work. You have to do that. And so you have to find, you know, we are attracted to this lineage and this path. So once you make that commitment, you don't have to, but it's your detriment. Once you've made the commitment to a path, you got to get busy and you got to practice. You got to do the things that your teacher and guru told you to do.
Right.
You know, you don't have to, but if you don't, well, you're probably not going to make it this lifetime. Or, you know, and those, and you've probably run into them there, you know, one day they're reading this book, the next day they're reading that book, this day they're following this teacher, or they're following Amma, or they're following Sadhguru, or they're going to India, and they never settle on one path and practice.
Right.
You know, they're always searching, and they're never really, and that's okay. Whatever people do is okay. It's not my place to tell them what to do, but if you're serious and you want to make spiritual progress, you got to find the best teacher and the best path that seems the best for you.
Right.
And then you've got to get busy.
Right.
Your Kriya Yoga, you got to practice your Kriya Yoga techniques. You know?
Well, that reminds me of a few sayings of Yogananda. You know, I remember hearing that he had said that, you know, you want to build a fire that's not like a brush fire that just goes up and burns brightly for a short period of time. You want a fire that you build up slowly and that burns slowly over a long period of time. And I do believe this was also attributed to him. He mentioned that when you're doing your spiritual practices, you want to focus on drilling one well deeply until you hit the water, rather than kind of going around and trying to, you know, drill for a few feet and then go drill somewhere else for a few feet, and then you never actually hit that spiritual water.
Absolutely, that's exactly right.
You know, right.
And Mr. Black said he was, for most of us, you know, he said there are some, he said, but they're few and far between. You know, like maybe like St. Paul in the New Testament, they have this almost seems like an instantaneous enlightenment.
Right.
But he said for most people, it's a dawning thing. It happens gradually over time, and there's this gradual awakening, mm-hmm. and you become more and more aware as time goes on. It isn't like, you know, Jesus comes and taps you on the shoulder and blows you into samadhi.
Right.
Says, you know, that just, he says it does happen, but it's so rare, it's, don't even think about it. Do your practice and let it evolve.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why, whether it's the internet or just the access to information these days, but, you know, many people, they hear stories about someone who's had a awakening experience, and then they think that's how it functions. And, you know, Mr. Davis would always, exactly what you just said, that once you start committing to a path, then the evolution begins. You know, then you slowly begin to change, you slowly begin to evolve, and it's not like, bam, one day it happens. It's, you look back over, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, and you recognize, you know, my spiritual awareness is quite a bit greater than it was all those years ago when I first got started. So I think it's an important point for people to recognize that is how most of us probably grow into our liberation.
And pay attention to your life. We're all, sometimes we get so busy looking at others and what they're doing. And, you know, sometimes people aren't quite as honest as you might think they are. They embellish some of their experiences, and you get jealous maybe.
Right.
Why aren't I having those experiences? When the fact of the matter is you probably are having them and you don't pay enough attention.
Right. When, you know, when I think about what you mentioned about the Middle Ages and the fact that people only lived to be 30, you know, the other thing that we have going on in these times is that we have so many conveniences that we actually probably have more time now. Even, you know, even individuals I know who are working all the time, they're still living better than people in the Middle Ages. You know,
absolutely.
They've got
live like royalty of the Middle Ages.
Right. And when we're not, you know, I mean, that's the funny thing about it. So, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, in this particular time, it's hard to see. I think it's hard to see because of all the distractions, but we have a wonderful opportunity. People are living longer. You know, we don't have to wash our dishes all the time. Some of us do. I had to for many years, but, you know, most of us have dishwashers now. We don't have to take our horse and buggy and go miles to the store. We can just drive down the road and come right back. And all the time we have to be able to meditate, it's amazing if someone would actually stop and see that possibility.
It is. It's truly. And that's why I figured this out listening to him. You know, and maybe you planted this thought in me or whatever, is that that's why it's not that important to be a monastic these days. Because most people don't have the personality type to be a monastic. They just don't have it in them. But it's not necessary anymore, because you think about the Middle Ages again, and most people couldn't read or write. Mm. The only people that could read or write in those days were royalty and the clerics, mm-hmm. and everyone else was a peasant. They had tough lives. They didn't have time to meditate.
Right.
They were exhausted by the end of their day from working, and then they probably had some wine and got drunk, and they had a few babies, and they were dead by the time they were 35. Heck, think about when you were 35.
Right.
When I was 35, it's almost like I was just starting my life.
Right. I think we live in interesting times, and I think that there actually probably is a greater possibility of awakening if people would take advantage of what they do have, what is available to them.
That's right. And, you know, it's not quite as we make it out, you know, because it's part of our Christian heritage, I think, that you know, most of us were raised in the States as Christians. And there's this concept in Christianity of Jesus is the only Son of God. And even beyond that, you know, you get into Buddhism or Islam or, you know, then there's a few prophets. There's, you know, Muhammad started the Islamic religion, and, you know, there's only one of him, you know, and there's only one Buddha, even though if you're really into Buddhism, there's many Buddhas, but, you know, we primarily think of one.
Right.
And we make it almost unattainable.
Yes.
The reality is there's always a lot of realized beings on the planet, but hardly any of them are known by anybody. They have a few disciples and that's it. Nobody else knows about them. And I took this, Mr. Black said, even in the depths of the Dark Ages, there's 2,500 masters on the planet. And as we go through the cycles, it gets more. So I was thinking about that. You know, in the Gita, there's this one place it says, Krishna says, out of 1,000, one seeks me. And out of 1,000 who seek me, one knows me as I am. Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty daunting. But then I have a math major, so I figured that's one out of 1,000,000. And there's 7 billion people on the planet. So there could be 7,000 realized beings on the planet. In America, there's 300 million people. There might be 300 realized beings in the United States.
Right.
Even in Michigan, we got 10, 11 million people in Michigan. We might have 10 or 11 in Michigan. I'm being a little flippant by that.
No, I get it.
But my point is, they're not as rare. They are rare. Don't get me wrong. They're not falling off the trees, but it's not as rare as we think.
Well, I'm glad you quoted that, because again, someone had recently sent me a question. They quoted that Gita phrase, and essentially what they were leading up to was, well, if this is the case, you know, if one in 1,000 seeks the truth, and if, you know, one of them actually experiences the truth, the question was, it seemed to me, well, what does that mean, that I'm just sort of out of luck, or, you know, what hope do I have to do that? So how do you approach that? How would you answer that?
I would use my example. It's one out of 1,000,000. It seems daunting, but think about in your own life, how many people do you know in your circle? More now, because you've been in yoga for so long.
Right.
But before you started on this path, how many people did you know that were even seeking any of these things?
Exactly, yes.
Probably nobody.
Nobody, right.
One or two.
Yeah.
And so even though it is rare, it's not that rare. And it's all a matter of how badly do you want to get there. Mm-hmm. Because the initial thing is, you know, I think pretty much almost everyone has a spiritual experience in their life. Mm-hmm. So, but what happens? Well, most people, they either ignore it or it becomes a defining moment in their life, but they don't do anything about it.
Yes.
Well, the yogi says, boy, I like that. I'd like to get more of that. So they seek out, well, where does that come from? How do I do that? How do I have that experience more often? How do I make it more long-lasting? And then there opens up to the yogic path, and maybe they are lucky enough to find a guru, and then they figure out how to do it.
Right, right.
And once they do it, it's their responsibility to share it with others, those that are ready to come to them.
With that idea, you know, we have this path, and we have the Kriya Yoga practices, and we have the philosophy of Raj Yoga. And I remember Mr. Davis telling, again, a story one time that Yogananda had said to an individual, you have to want God so bad, just like, you know, you're underwater and you're drowning, and, you know, you want to get that breath of air, but you have to be okay if it doesn't happen today.
I think about that, and I think, boy, oh boy, am I really ready for that? You know,
right.
But that's why we have these techniques, because they work scientifically, and they get you there. That's why it's important to have bhakti. But bhakti in itself is a little unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But if you mash it with the Kriya Yoga practices, then it's a sure bet.
Right, right. Yeah.
And it may take you longer, depends how hard you practice, but you know you're going to get there.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody's going to get there eventually, but you want to do it now, this life, or do you want to wait for 100 lifetimes more? You
know? Right. Good. Well, we're coming near our time for today, and I've really thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, and I think that we've covered a lot of good ground. But one final question I have for you is, if you could say something about the path itself, and if someone is sincere about walking this path, about, you know, exploring Kriya Yoga, what would you recommend that they do? How would you recommend that they proceed to learn Kriya Yoga and then apply it into their life? What's just a general idea, if you could share one?
Well, I think it's a progression. I think in America today, almost all of us can read or write. So I think with most Americans today, it starts with an awakening type book. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Bhagavad Gita, which for most people, it's not going to be the Gita, but something like the autobiography. Because it tells a story that's engrossing as well as imparting philosophical information. And so there's got to be something that all of a sudden spurs you to say, okay, that's what I want.
Right.
That's what I want in my life. And then I think you got to find a guru, or at the very least, like-minded people that you can begin to associate with. In my life today, I have to say I almost have no friends that aren't yogis. And that was both an unconscious and a conscious decision. I didn't want to have friends that weren't yogis. And so I'd never associated with people that weren't yogis. I had to a little bit in my career because I had a family. I had to provide,
right,
food, shelter, and clothing. So you have to get out in the world. And that's not a bad thing either. But my friends are all yogis. Mm-hmm. And my dearest friend was Yogacharya. And I got around him as much as I could. And then, many years after Yogacharya passed, I never had any desire to follow anyone else. He did everything I needed for me. And I was curious about Roy, and he's the same lineage. I had friends that went Sadhguru and Amma and various other people, but I didn't have any interest in that because I had found my path, I'd found my guru, but Roy was in the same path, so that was interesting to me.
Right.
I'm so happy that I did find him. Really, he was a mentor to me for a number of years.
Right.
It gave me a chance to be ordained so I could give Kriya with proper authorization, and Mr. Black never did that because he couldn't and stay part of SRF.
They
didn't allow him to do that. But I think that's the progression. You have some sort of impulsive awakening, either by a book or meeting someone, something that really moves you to say, I want to change my life. I want to become one of those type of people. And then you've got to seek at least one out that's already done the work, that's already done it. And you go and you follow their example. I wouldn't say I'm Mr. Black, but you know what? I think I followed him pretty closely. Mm-hmm. He's such a major influence in my life that it couldn't help but change me. And so that's how you change, just like the yamas and niyamas.
Right.
A lot of change, you go with, be around people who like you want to be.
And you mentioned listening to recordings of Oliver Black. And before we did this podcast, I happened to be poking around the internet and I did find some videos. Do you have any particular source you'd recommend, or are these just personal recordings that you have?
I have so many. I probably have, 12 or 13 videos. In the 85 and 86, he started doing these video recorded satsangas at the retreat. And I also have probably a couple hundred hours of audio. Used to record his services at he did them at the Detroit Institute of Arts.
Okay.
And I I was able to obtain most of them. I made a website called yogacharyaoliver.com.
Okay.
And you can go on there, and I don't have them all. They needed to be edited because, remember, most of these were done in the 60s.
Right.
The equipment wasn't that good. I had to convert them all to digital MP3s, and I converted all of the VHS to MP4s. And so those that I have edited enough, I sell them online. But I have them all, so I listen to another one every day.
Right. So these can be found at yogacharyaoliver.com, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I'll put a link in the liner notes as well for people who are interested.
Yeah, it gives a lot of information about Yogacharya, who he was, where he came from. You know, you may know this, but Yogananda, Mr. Black, James Lynn, and Dr. Lewis were all born within 14 months of each other.
No, I did not know that.
three of them in the same year, 1893.
Wow.
That tells you something about the mission that Yogananda had in the United States.
Yes, that's true. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. And again, I wish you all the best in your work. And I look forward to seeing you again sometime soon. You know, I think it's been many years since I've seen you.
No, this was fun. I enjoyed it. And anytime you want to talk or message or whatever, come on up and visit the retreat sometime. That's fine.
That sounds great. We'll do it.
All right.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This episode of the Kriya Yoga Podcast was made possible by donations from Kriya Yoga Apprenticeship students and supporters of our Patreon community at www.patreon.com/KriyaYoga.